seriously popular.
Have you ever felt like escaping to your own desert island? Jane Gaskin did exactly that, trading in the family home to begin a new life in the tropics. But she soon discovers that paradise has its secrets. I'm Alice Levine, and this is The Price of Paradise, the island dream that ends in kidnap, corruption, and murder. Wish you were here? Follow The Price of Paradise now, wherever you listen to podcasts.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
In January 2023, Constance Martin and her boyfriend, Mark Gordon, disappeared and went on the run with their newborn baby, Victoria.
A nationwide search resulted in the sad discovery of Victoria's body, and the pair have now been charged with killing her, which they both deny.
I'm Jack Hardy, a news reporter for the Daily Mail. I'll be in court every day, reporting the events as they happen.
And I'm broadcaster and journalist Caroline Cheetham. Together, we'll take you behind the headlines, bringing you the evidence, witness statements, and testimony from the Old Bailey in London.
This is The Trial. Constance Martin and Mark Gordon.
So it was a big day in the trial yesterday, and it's going to be a significant week. And that's because the jury have now heard all of the evidence in this case. They've heard from all of the witnesses, and this trial is now definitely reaching the end. So that means the closing speeches, Jack, have started.
Yeah, Caroline. So we said on Friday that this jury have now been sitting since January the 25th, which means we're 11 weeks in. It's now reaching the end, and very shortly, this jury of 6 men and 5 women will be sent out by the judge to consider their verdict. But first, as you say, we'll bring you the closing speeches. And the point of these is that they give the prosecution and the defence the opportunity to sum up their case, to remind the jury of the key facts which have emerged, or to try to dispute some of the witnesses or evidence.
Yeah, so in jury trials in England and Wales, the defence always have the last word. That's just the way it works. So we'll be hearing from John Femi-Ola KC, the barrister for Mark Gordon, and from Francis Fitzgibbon KC, Constance Martin's barrister, later this week. But first to address the jury was prosecutor Tom Little KC, and today we'll bring you his words.
He told the jury that Constance Martin and Mark Gordon were two selfish and arrogant individuals, and baby Victoria was caught in the middle of their toxic relationship.
He said Constance Martin's days in the witness box were just bluster and lies. Lies, he added, which fell from her lips like confetti in the wind.
He said baby Victoria was freezing cold with only a single baby grow to keep her warm, and the couple's plan to say their daughter had suffered a cot death showed they had something to hide.
And he said the cold, harsh, brutal reality of the case was Victoria never stood a chance.
Welcome to episode 19, Big Fat Lies.
So Jack, Tom Little began his closing speech by taking the jury back to their first day arriving at the Old Bailey in January, when they were forced to queue up in the cold outside because the security scanners were broken. He said, as they queued, they may have been hoping for an interesting trial, and he suggested that is exactly what they got.
Now, he said his closing speech would be divided into 3 parts. General observations about the defendants, a summary and commentary of the evidence, which, he said, revealed the inconsistencies and fabrications which lie at the heart of the shallow and sham defences which the defendants had orchestrated before them in this case. And finally, a short analysis drawing the strands of evidence together, count by count. His words are voiced by an actor.
When you strip away Constance Martin's very late version of events in her last interviews, only after the dead body of baby Victoria had been found by the police, with no assistance from the defendants, in fact, quite the opposite, hidden, and there's no beating around the bush about this, hidden deliberately, like rubbish, in that bag for life containing waste and detritus, wearing only a soiled nappy. When you strip away her days and days of bluster, distraction, and when you force open the zip on that flimsy, thin tent with flimsy sleeping bags that were plainly not suitable for the conditions for even hardy individuals, when you undo that zip and look inside that tent, we say that you can see what actually was happening inside that tent in January and February 2023. It is not what Constance Martin told you.
Mr. Little said it was also not what Professor Fleming had told the jury either. The expert witness, he said, had given the impression that the Mongolian tents he'd stood in were bitterly cold at night and regularly the conditions were sub-zero. But actually, the temperatures inside the Mongolian gears were warmer than the tent that Constance Martin and Mark Gordon were in with baby Victoria on the South Downs, he said. They were insulated. The professor's suggestion during his evidence that temperatures in the Mongolian gears would fall well below freezing in the evenings was partial and misleading.
The reason that this matters is actually a subtle distinction that there is in this case, because Professor Fleming understood the distinction between the position of the Mongolian heavily insulated gears and that flimsy tent. But Constance Martin's evidence doesn't accept this subtle distinction. People sleep in tents all over the world, she told you. Oh, yes, they do. Jesus was born in a barn. Yes, but Bethlehem is hardly a skiing destination, is it? Tents in Calais for people who are trying to come to this country are going to have fires outside or next to them. So, all of these attempts by Constance Martin to draw analogies fail at the first hurdle. People who use those types of heavily insulated gears in Mongolia have done it for generation upon generation. That is why they are so heavily insulated. They have no baby grows and a vest. They have ample sleeping equipment, ample day and night clothing. Baby Victoria had none of that.
Mr. Little said it was crystal clear that Constance Martin did not understand this point even now, and he urged the jury not to be distracted by the comparisons to other parts of the world unless the comparison was properly undertaken.
This was on the evidence, we say, a self-absorbed relationship between two selfish and arrogant individuals. And caught in the middle of that toxic relationship was a baby that was manifestly not cared for properly. Manifestly not, despite protestations to the contrary, being looked after properly. She was neglected and was exposed to dangerous conditions.
Baby Victoria, he said, was freezing cold, and she had just a single baby grow to keep her warm. No hat was ever seen or ever found, he said. No camouflage gilet, as Constance Martin had described, as this was left abandoned next to the car on the M61. No sub-zero zip-up sleeping bag, as Constance Martin had described either. Mr. Little said it was no coincidence that the only baby clothes found after the couple's arrest matched the clothes that were visible on the CCTV. The other clothing, he said, either never existed or was dumped by the roadside when the couple first went on the run.
It was dumped either literally on or close to the M61 or in the playing fields alongside with the cat. That tells you everything you need to know about how quickly they wanted to get away.
It was this freezing baby girl, Mr. Little said, who was heard crying by one witness on consecutive nights in mid to late January, when the weather was bitterly cold, and at least a week after Constance Martin said the baby had died.
In her very short life, baby Victoria, we say, and as I said when I opened this case many weeks ago, did not stand a chance. We say that is the cold, harsh, brutal reality of this case. There's no point in soft-soaping it. We say that despite the best tactical efforts of the defendants in deciding whether or not to give evidence, we have forced open the zip on the flimsy tent and shone a bright light into that cramped and dangerous space and what was actually happening on or after January the 9th, 2023.
He said the jury had seen the tent and some of them sat inside it, which allowed them to see it was small and cramped for two adults. The lack of space meant the risks were obvious, he said. It was manifestly not a safe sleeping area. He said the defendants had worked hard to keep the reality of what happened in the tent zipped up and away from the jury's gaze. He said in the same way that medical professionals were serially misled and lied to by Constance Martin, she had sought to mask the reality of the case by picking and choosing what questions to answer from the police.
Mark Gordon, he said, had clearly realised over the weekend before he was due to give evidence that he would not be able to keep up the false account when he was pressed about what aspects of his interview were true, and he would finally have to say something other than demanding crisps and chocolate. Mr. Little claimed Mark Gordon chose not to take the short steps to the witness box because he did not dare.
But of course, in contrast, Constance Martin, we suggest, realised she was going to have to develop her false narrative, and lies fell from her mouth like confetti in the wind as she gave evidence. We suggest the notion that she is a reliable, let alone an honest, witness is risible. Her evidence comes with a monumental health warning. She was and is an utterly unreliable, self-interested witness. Let's just consider one stone-cold truth in this case. Baby Victoria would still be alive if it was not for the actions and inactions of those two defendants.
He told the court the couple's first four children were lawfully and properly taken into care, and everyone could see and should see that, apart from Constance Martin. He said baby Victoria would still be alive if they had decided to wait at the side of the M61, if they had accepted eyewitness Dale Gosling's invitation to come back to his home in Harwich, if they had walked into a police station at any point.
That's the starting point in this case. That's the starting point in the real world, not in Martin world, where the earth is flat, or Fleming world, where there are unicorns. In the real world, they caused the death of baby Victoria.
Mr. Little told the jury that the couple did everything to hide the existence of the baby, to the extent Victoria is scarcely seen on any CCTV. He said one such occasion was in the German Doner kebab shop, when Constance Martin could be seen manhandling, or what he said would be better described as woman mishandling, the baby.
He asked the jury to consider why the defendants discussed making up a deliberately false narrative about a cot death and what this tells them about the defendant's mindset. And he questioned what sort of innocent person would make something up like that. And he suggested it would be the type of person who's something to hide and is to blame for the death of their child. And Jack, he also actually questioned why Constance Martin had pleaded not guilty to two of the counts that she faces.
Yeah, so these are count one, which is concealing the birth of a child, and count five, perverting the course of justice. Now, Tom Little said she had effectively accepted both of those counts in her own evidence.
Even on Constance Martin's evidence, it's difficult to see why she pleaded not guilty to counts one and five. You may be scratching your head slightly about that. Of course, in Martin world, and for that matter, in Gordon world, you do the opposite of what you should do. You act selfishly. You act dangerously. They've got no defence to those two charges. We suggest at the end of her evidence, if not earlier in her evidence, she essentially accepted that what she was doing was intending to pervert the course of justice. She was hoping to keep the child's body a secret.
He said it was clear from her own account that Constance Martin knew there was very little evidence the baby ever existed. The couple, he said, knew there was a significant police investigation and there was no credible reason for what they did with Victoria's body after she died other than to pervert the course of justice.
On any analysis of the evidence, they caused the death of baby Victoria. Nobody else was in that tent. Nobody else made the decision to go into the wilds in January. She did not, despite her protestations to the contrary, do the best any mother could do.
Mr. Little then urged the jury to focus their analysis on the whole of the evidence and not just a snapshot of it. He said they didn't need to resolve every factual dispute in the case and cautioned them against getting bogged down in the many false narratives of Constance Martin about the couple's history with social services. The jurors, he said, were the only people who had access to all the evidence, something that was not true of the experts. This is trial by jury, not trial by expert, he told them.
So then he turned his attention to the decision by Mark Gordon not to give evidence.
Gordon made the deliberate decision that his best chance of being acquitted was not giving evidence. Why else would you not give evidence in a case? What has he got to hide? He was there. although he was not very keen to say that in interview. He can tell you where she died, but he hasn't. His silence is, we say, deafening.
Mr. Little said it was ironic in the extreme that Mark Gordon grandstanded to such an extent in his police interviews about his belief in the jury system, but then refused to give evidence. And he criticised Constance Martin's approach to giving evidence during the trial, saying a witness who has nothing to hide answers the questions put to them, not the questions they hope to be asked. Instead, her cross-examination at the hands of his fellow prosecutor Joel Smith had taken days.
Had Constance Martin been such a witness, Mr. Smith's cross-examination would have taken not much more than a couple of hours, instead of how many days it took. Why? Because she wouldn't answer the question. There was grandstanding on a Premier League level. There was prevarication. There was picking and choosing when she could remember something clearly and when she couldn't. But perhaps more gratuitously on her part, throwing everyone outrageously under the bus. Apart from her and her wonderful husband. Everyone is evil and bad, apart from her and Mr. Gordon, in Constance Martin world.
So Mr. Little said there were three types of defendant who give evidence in a criminal trial. The first is someone who is innocent and gives a clear, truthful explanation because they have nothing to hide. The second is a less impressive defendant, but the jury are left with some doubts which must be exercised in their favour. And then there were defendants who had the opposite effect, that upon analysis their account comes unstuck because it is warped and twisted to fit a false narrative. Constance Martin, he said, fitted into that final category of defendant.
You'll recall the day she walked down with her plastic wallet of documents that she brought to and from the dock every time she gave evidence, tossing in references to relevant documents left, right and centre in the unused material at will. The result in a case such as that is the evidence actually assists the prosecution by providing yet further support of the allegation they make. I will deal with a number of what I call big fat lies told by Constance Martin. There's no beating around the bush about it. They're not white lies. They're not fibs. They're demonstrable lies that go to the core issues in this case. They permeate the case. They are the sort of lies that not even Professor Fleming, if he's been honest with himself, could or should ignore. He did, but you, in a trial by jury, should not.
One of these lies, he said, was her dispute about the buggy, the type of buggy and, crucially, the type of muff it had attached. Now, this part of the evidence goes back a few weeks, but basically Constance Martin claimed the buggy the prosecution said Victoria was in for a short time was not the right one.
One most obvious lie, as Constance Martin sucked her teeth at Mr. Smith and accused him of being patronising, was about the buggy. Remember that indignation on her part? You've got the wrong buggy, Mr. Smith. I've been asking my solicitors for weeks and months to get the right buggy. There was deliberate reference to a sub-zero sleeping bag with a zip, the sort of level of detail that, if it was true, you might remember. No. No, Miss Martin. You've got the wrong muff. It was thicker. It had a zip. It was bigger. That's what she was saying. Remember all that indignation about it. But there was no sub-zero sleeping bag with the zipper that came with that buggy. There was a foot muff. A foot muff that was not used to keep the baby warm, but as you would have seen from the CCTV footage, was actually put over the top of the baby in the buggy to hide the baby. It wasn't even being used to keep the baby warm. It was being used as a method to hide the baby in the limited amount of time it was pushed around before the buggy was dumped. You know, on the evidence, the prosecution have the right buggy.
Mr. Little said, following Constance Martin's protestations about the buggy, police had gone back to the Argos in East London where Mark Gordon had bought it and made further inquiries, finding out the make and model number and that it was the only buggy bought in the shop during that period of time. Police obtained exactly the same buggy. There could be no dispute about this, he said, because the defence had the opportunity to challenge the police officer about the evidence she had given when she was in the witness box, but they didn't. Mr. Little had the buggy next to him as he gave his closing speech.
So, this is the buggy. It does not have a sub-zero sleeping bag. It does not have a muff with a zip. The defence for Miss Martin must have known that she had shot herself in the foot spectacularly with her gloss and lie about the nature of the Sub-Zero sleeping back. They had weeks to produce a different buggy. Weeks to get this mythical Sub-Zero sleeping bag, work out where on earth that fits into this case. They haven't done so because she lied in evidence about it. Nothing could be clearer. But it goes further than that. Why was she trying to bolster a sham defence? The use of the phrase Sub-Zero. Don't forget, Constance Martin is an intelligent woman. She knows the use of that type of rhetorical language, oratory. It brings with it a message, Sub-Zero, as though it was a brand name she could remember. So there are layers to this. It was the indignant approach. It was trying to fob you off, in essence. It was a deliberate piece of language. And it was a demonstrable lie. You were probably waiting and expecting a different buggy or a big thin muff, that there was going to be some kind of muff-off in this case between this version and the mythical version she was saying, but there was none of it. This is important, because the level of warmth, the level of clothing, the level of protection that Victoria had against the elements is an important aspect of this case. So, a demonstrable lie about that goes to the heart of the case, as well as her attempts to trick you that we had the wrong foot muff. Well, we've got the right foot muff.
Mr. Little suggested that in all likelihood the foot muff was left in North London when the couple dumped the buggy shortly before they began their journey to the South Downs. And this, he said, brought him to another lie. He said Constance Martin claimed they dumped the buggy because they couldn't get it into a black taxi, but it would have fitted easily into a black cab, he said. Common sense suggested they hadn't taken the buggy with them because they knew it wouldn't fit in the tent. And if they were only going to be in the tent for a day or two, this would be no reason to throw away the buggy, because they knew they would need it before long when they tried to flee the country. He said the only reason they left the buggy was because they knew they were going to live off-grid long-term.
What really mattered, Mr. Little said, wasn't so much the lie as the righteous indignation Constance Martin had shown at being asked questions about it by Joel Smith.
This was, we suggest, well crafted as an act on her part to try and pull the wool over your eyes and try to fool you into thinking there was more equipment than there was. Because we know, we suggest, that all there was a solitary vest and a baby grove. That is all that baby had.
And he said the lie that Constance Martin had told about the items they had for baby Victoria had exploded in her face. He said the only reason she would lie about that is because the amount of clothing the baby had is relevant to how she died. He said it fundamentally undermined her credibility.
So he moved on to what he said was the next lie, and this was Constance Martin's reference to a duvet she said they had in the tent. He claimed she had to reverse course on this claim because she realised it wouldn't have been able to fit in the bags that they were seen carrying on CCTV, along with everything else. So he said the duvet became a quilt. Even then, he said there would have clearly been limited space to fit a quilt.
Another example of Constance Martin's lying, he said, was what he called the imaginary car seat. There was no trace of the car seat she claimed they had in their possession in the burnt-out car, he said. The placenta and the blanket survived the fire, so the car seat would also have survived. Nor was a car seat seen when their previous car broke down several days after she claimed the baby was born.
Why lie about the car seat unless the impression was meant to be that they were more caring parents than was the reality?
He said the reality must have been that Victoria was carried around in cars by one or other of the defendants or in another bag for life.
How is that safe? But it's that type of lie, alongside her tendency to lie to anyone and everyone, if it will help her, which is critical, we say, to your analysis of this case. Not least because she told you that it was justifiable to accuse social workers of criminal acts they have not committed, just to get her own way. Where on the moral compass does that approach come? Twice in evidence, she accepted she was happy to lie to protect herself and her family, and that's precisely what she is trying to do in this trial. She told you, sometimes you have to lie. No, you don't. Not to the police. Not to you. Not to Professor Fleming. There are layers to these lies. Another lie, we suggest, was her suggestion that somehow the police have manipulated the body-worn footage. Again, these are lies and allegations that are just tossed into the air like confetti. The reality, and it's a brutal reality in this case, is that the truth and Constance Martin barely know each other, as the evidence in this trial reveals.
We'll take a break there.
Have you ever felt like escaping to your own desert island? Jane Gaskin did exactly that, trading in the family home to begin a new life in the tropics. But she soon discovers that paradise has its secrets. I'm Alice Levine, and this is The Price of Paradise, the island dream that ends in kidnap, corruption, and murder. Wish you were here? Follow The Price of Paradise now, wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome back, and we're going to continue with Tom Little's closing speech to the jury. And once he dealt with what he called Constance Martin's big fat lies, he turned to his analysis of the way Professor Fleming had conducted himself when he appeared as the expert witness in her defence case. He said no one could doubt his many years of experience, but there were some real problems with his evidence.
You need to understand the limitations of expert evidence when they simply accept what a witness has said and proceed on that basis. That is a critical matter. He was not willing to even accept that any matters that went back in terms of historical lies mattered at all. But he was lied to about the clothing. He was told that they had bought clothing for the baby in London. No, they hadn't. There's a demonstrable lie from the serial liar to Professor Fleming on which he relies. You need to understand the limitations of Professor Fleming's evidence because it is based on a tissue of lies. If you strip away the account that she has given to him, his opinion falls away. Even he reluctantly had to accept that, albeit through slightly gritted teeth. You may have thought that he was combative, very defensive, very aggressive. You'll recall that even in examination in chief, he had to be repeatedly reined in about what he was entitled to say, rather than being a potential mouthpiece for his client. In short, we suggest that he descended plainly into the arena. That is not, we suggest, the place for a reliable, independent witness. Why did he find it so difficult to answer a simple question? How many post-mortems have you conducted, Professor Fleming? The answer was none. But remember how long it took to get there? He could have answered and decided to clarify if he wanted to. He doesn't need to be defensive, does he? What sort of independent witness does that?
Mr. Little also said Professor Fleming had even accused him of lying, and he questioned what sort of independent expert would do that.
Mr. Little then returned again, this time in more detail, to Mark Gordon and his failure to give evidence. He said Mark Gordon clearly wasn't mute because he was capable of demanding crisps and chocolate at the roadside shortly after being arrested, treating police, he said, as if they were fast food vendors. During his police interviews, Mark Gordon referred to juries on at least 100 occasions, Mr. Little said. Yet he refused to go into the witness box when his moment finally arrived.
We suggest that he was concerned that he would not be able to explain away the tension that there is from his account in interview, And what was being said on behalf of Constance Martin? He must have felt it was better and safer to leave the more articulate liar to tell lies on her own, without risk of any inconsistencies which would cause problems for them both.
The jury were then taken by Mr. Little through various extracts from Mark Gordon's police interviews, including his repeated insistence that he would save his account for the jury, and he made lots of references to the Magna Carta. Mr. Little said at one stage, Mark Gordon's language became almost Trump-esque as he spoke about the rights that are enshrined in our country, describing them as part of what makes Great Britain great.
He said that even the short account that Mark Gordon did give, in which he said they both fell asleep on the baby, was not what Constance Martin said, and he accused him of fishing for information from police officers during his interviews to work out what false version of events Constance Martin had provided. One example Mr. Little highlighted was when Mark Gordon was asked by police if they had a car seat for Victoria, and he replied she was safe and secure. Mr. Little said the reason he did not answer that simple question was because they both knew there wasn't a car seat, but he didn't know what she had said during her own police interviews.
He said these inconsistencies were important and that Mark Gordon would have been asked about them in detail if he'd been cross-examined. He said the most telling refusal to commit to any detail came when he was asked if Victoria had died in a house or if they were outside. Mr. Little said this was because Mark Gordon was unsure about the precise extent of the lies that Constance Martin had told.
That was a whistle-stop tour through the inconsistent account and the interviews where he fails to answer the questions he was asked, which were straightforward questions for him to answer if Constance Martin told you the truth.
Mr. Little said the prosecution's case was based in part on circumstantial evidence. Circumstantial evidence is not, he said, a poor relation to direct evidence. In fact, quite the opposite, because criminality often happens behind closed doors. He said the circumstantial evidence in this case was cumulatively compelling.
He then moved on to analysing the evidence in the case, turning first to the family court proceedings, and we know this resulted in the couple's four children being put up for adoption.
It is important you understand the decisions made by the independent judge sitting in the family court are ones that firstly she was entitled to make based on the material available to her. And secondly, there can be no going behind any of the determinations she made. Any challenge to those findings would be for a higher court, and there had been no such appeal heard by a higher court. In effect, the determinations stand.
These legal directions also made clear that the jury has to determine what happened in late 2022 and early 2023, and their deliberation should be informed by what the defendants were told during earlier dealings with social services in the family court. Mr. Little said the couple were not driven off-grid, to use what he described as John Femiola's emotive language at the beginning of the trial.
You must approach your determinations in this case not in some Wild West Constance Martin world, but in the real world. The obvious thing to do was inform the authorities she was pregnant, to engage with the authorities, to ensure perhaps that they could have care of Victoria. Accepting past mistakes, but none of it. Instead, she wants to rewrite history. That is the reality of this case.
Mr. Little then outlined the lies Constance Martin had told health professionals when she was in labour with her first child. Now, this, you might remember, was when she put on that Irish accent and pretended to be a traveller, providing the hospital with fake names for her and Mark Gordon, who she said at that point was a friend. Now, Mr. Little said these were significant lies that could not be airbrushed away as fibs or white lies. He reminded the jury of the couple's history with social services and said they had to proceed on the basis that the children were taken lawfully away from the defendants.
It's critical that you do so. Constance Martin has attempted to rewrite history and to warp history. We rely on that to a certain extent to show the lengths she's willing to go.
Mr. Little then turned to some of the witness evidence, starting with the evidence of the breakdown company worker who came to pick up the couple on December the 28th after their Suzuki broke down. Now, this is not to be confused with the car that broke down a few days later when it burst into flames on the motorway near Bolton. Mr. Little said the evidence was important because it called into question the baby's supposed date of birth, which Constance Martin said was December the 24th. The witness did not say anything about seeing a car seat and did not see a baby at any point. He said he couldn't see through the back or side windows as they had been blocked by clothing and it appeared the couple had been living out of the car.
He said at this stage the couple had nothing to hide. Nobody knew about the baby and there was not yet any missing persons inquiry. So he questioned why they'd been so reluctant to firstly leave the car when asked to do so and then to give the keys to the breakdown company employee. Mr. Little asked what they had to hide. He said in this witness's evidence and in evidence relating to the car which burst into flames a few days later, Mr. Gordon was described as being on the driver's side of the car, despite both defendants claiming he didn't know how to drive.
Where was the baby? And why was it being hidden? Because this was all before the big fire. There was no involvement of the emergency services. There was no involvement of the police. Why is there any need at this point to be hiding anything? You are going to have to consider, therefore, if the baby was born after the 24th of December, and if so, why Constance Martin has lied about that.
So that was as far as Tom Little got in his closing speech. There is more to come, and we'll be bringing that and the rest of the closing speeches to you across the week. But just before we finish, we wanted to mention some legal directions the jury have been given by the judge. And this is what they've basically been told needs to be proved in the case on each charge.
Yeah, so in relation to count one, which is concealing the birth of a child, the judge said, from the evidence before them, the jury may well think it is clear that no one knew Constance Martin was pregnant and that when she gave evidence, Constance Martin stressed they didn't want anyone to know. He said there was no antenatal or postnatal medical checks to mother or baby and the baby was not born in the hospital. Also, he said, in much of the CCTV, the baby is hidden from public view. And the judge said the jury may well come to the conclusion from all of the evidence that they can safely infer that both defendants acted at all times intending to and did conceal the birth of the child. Now, a second element of the charge, he said, is based on the prosecution's claim that the couple secretly disposed of the body of Victoria. In legal terms, he said, this simply meant disposing of the body without others knowing or seeing, so leaving it in a place it's unlikely to be found. The law, he said, does not require for the baby to be completely hidden and incapable of being found. And the judge said the baby's body was found in a shopping bag underneath rubbish in an unlocked shed, and the body was in a decomposed state. The death had not been reported, and when the defendants were each initially interviewed, they refused to say where the baby was, an attitude which only changed once they'd been told the baby had been found.
Now, on count two, which is child cruelty, the judge said the prosecution alleged the child had been willfully neglected or exposed to the elements, the cold, the wind and the rain. He said the jury would have to decide when the baby died, the weather at the time, where they were living and the way in which they used the tent and what resources they had available to them, things like money.
On count three, which was causing or allowing the death of a child, the judge said there were some factual questions which the jury needed to be sure of. First, that one or both defendants caused the death through an unlawful act. This would in part depend on whether they decided if the couple were guilty of the previous count, which was child cruelty, as this would then be an unlawful act. They would then question whether either exposure or neglect led to the death of the child. Now, the judge said the prosecution alleged the baby was exposed to the cold in a tent without proper access to heating or adequate clothing, which they say gave rise to an obvious risk of hypothermia.
But the judge also said they had to consider whether the death was a result of smothering when asleep and whether this amounted to neglect. He said the jurors would have to be satisfied the defendants both knew there was a significant risk of serious harm from co-sleeping. The judge said they would need to consider the warnings given to them in the past, the impact of living off-grid, the exhaustion they both experienced through sleep deprivation, and the description of how baby Victoria was positioned. He said they would have to be sure it amounted to an unlawful act rather than an accident.
So on count four, which is manslaughter by gross negligence, he said both defendants accepted they had a duty of care to Victoria. And the jury would have to consider whether they breached that duty of care and if it was reasonably foreseeable that breach would give rise to a serious and obvious risk of death. Now this, he said, was an objective test. The test is not whether the defendants realised there was such a risk, but rather whether, by the standards of a reasonably competent parent, it was reasonably foreseeable that such a risk could exist. Then they would have to decide whether any such breach of the duty of care was a significant contributory factor in Victoria's death.
And finally, on the fifth count, he said the prosecution alleged that the defendants had concealed the body of Victoria, allowing it to decompose to such a degree that expert pathologists were unable to give an opinion as to the cause of death. The prosecution, he said, had suggested there can be no other reason for them to conceal the body. The defendants were fully aware of the police investigation into their whereabouts and concerns for the well-being of the baby, he said. So that's it for today. You are now up to date. And as we said, we'll be here across this week to bring you the closing speeches of all the barristers in this case as the trial nears the end.
Constance Martin and Mark Gordon deny manslaughter by gross negligence. They also deny perverting the course of justice, concealing the birth of a child, child cruelty, and causing or allowing the death of a child.
You can follow us on X at The Trial Podcast or contact us on thetrial@mailmetromedia.co.uk.
You can leave a comment on Spotify or even send us a voice note on WhatsApp on 07796 657 512. Start your message with the word trial.
See you then.